It's Monday, March 25th, 2024. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. NBC had no contingency for staff insurgency due to the hiring of a former head of the RNC. The network announced the hiring of Ronna McDaniel as a political expert, and the NBC staff wasn't having it. They ran her off. Wow. If you are NBC HR, you gotta hate it when the longest-running show in television history puts you in the crosshairs. But that's what Meet the Press did. After Ronna McDaniel, former head of the RNC, sat down for an interview with host Kristen Welker. Soon after that interview was taped, but before it was aired on Sunday, McDaniel was hired by NBC News, and former Meet the Press anchor Chuck Todd turned to his bosses for that decision.
I think our bosses owe you an apology for putting you in this situation, because I don't know what to believe. She is now a paid contributor by NBC News. So I have no idea whether any answer she gave to you was because she didn't want to mess up her contract. She wants us to believe that she was speaking for the RNC when the RNC was paying for her. So she has credibility issues that she still has to deal with.
NBC political editor Carrie Budoff Brown said in a statement, it couldn't be a more important moment to have a voice like Ronna's on the team. What voice is that? A lying voice? Said Todd, former Republican consultant Steve Schmidt, and MSNBC morning host Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough, when actually not asked for their opinion. There is some noise about McDaniel not being used on air. Seems a little bit overqualified to change coffee filters, but maybe she could spot irregularities in the system, as she did with Michigan voting. NBC, with their hiring, does open itself up to criticism from the right. I mean, the network does have Jen Psaki and Simone Sanders Townsend hosting shows. And those are two recent Democratic spokespeople. They haven't ruffled feathers at all internally within the network. But the entire staff is now in high dudgeon about the McDaniel hiring. Why? Because of partisan politics? Well, I think it's more personal politics. McDaniel was such a jerk to them when she was at the RNC. In any case, if MSNBC viewers are given access to the insights of Ronna McDaniel, I do not know how many minds would change. Personally, if I had to pick between a world with Jen Psaki at a network and no Ronna McDaniel, it seems to be the world we're going to have, and we've had it until now, or a world with Ronna McDaniel and Jen Psaki at the network, I would, like 13% of the Michigan electorate, vote uncommitted. I want neither one of them or people in those equivalent positions as my political commentators. Networks committed to the traditional presentation of news are in kind of a bind. How do you represent the voices of almost 50% of the electorate without giving a Trump supporter airtime? But most networks are actually not committed to the traditional presentation of news. They're a bit siloed, or very much siloed. They deliver to a niche audience. That said, network executives have discernment over who they hire, and Ronna McDaniel comes in with much more of a record of dishonesty than even your average non-Trump-inflected or affected politician. It's a true conundrum, except it's not. MSNBC is going to go on staying true to its brand, which is that of the place that stands up to Trump and Trumpism. If anything, this entire incident cements their bona fides on that score. On the show today, I spiel about Trump's big bond reduction. But first, some of the most sympathetic residents of the state of Indiana got bad news recently. And we're talking about families with members who are disabled or elderly who need home care. For a time, the federal government had provided funds so that family members could be paid a little bit to do this. But then the money ran out after more families availed themselves of the funds, but after a forecasting error. So what does the state and others like it do now? The tension between funding an expensive program and dedicating resources to the people who need it most. Whitney Downard is a reporter for the Indiana Capital Chronicle. She joins me to explain.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. During the pandemic, a lot of states got federal money, and some of the states, Indiana among them, used it to change existing laws. Now, home care provided by relatives to seriously ill children and adults would be reimbursed at certain levels for certain amounts of hours by the states. Well, since that money has dried up, and also due to some complications in accounting, Indiana is one of the states where, I don't know if you want to say the bill has come due, but they have to take a serious look at permanent funding mechanisms for people who, say, have an autistic child that they care for. How much an hour can the state afford to pay those people? And this is a legitimate argument. Should the state be reimbursing parents at all? Parents, of course, it is their obligation to care for children or older adults who need care. And why should taxpayers have to foot a bill that had never been paid before? Maybe if the answer is, well, there's plenty of money out there to do it. That's one set of considerations. Now that there's less money, it's another. And the state is actually making those decisions. There's also, and we'll get into this in our interview, a layer of possible corruption involved covering this for the Indiana Capital Chronicle, which is part of the state's newsroom program, is Whitney Downard. Hi, Whitney. Welcome to The Gist.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Could you give us your thumbnail, your precis about what the situation is in Indiana, how we got to where we are now, and then we'll pick it up from where we are now?
Yeah, so what happened was back in December, the Family and Social Services Administration, FSSA for short, announced that they had a $1 billion shortfall in their Medicaid budget, specifically for the craft our budgets in Indiana every 2 years. So they were speaking about a $1 billion shortfall essentially over the remaining 18 months of the cycle. And so they said that enrollment had gone up a little bit, but that really it was expenses in aged and disabled waiver care. So, you know, over the ensuing months, we got a lot more detail, but at the onset, all we knew was there was a $1 billion short and it was specifically in this subcategory of Medicaid.
And $1 billion, I mean, people listening to this in Delaware might say, oh, $1 billion. People listening in New York might say, oh, $1 billion. What's $1 billion to Indiana?
Yeah, so our budget, you know, is roughly $44 billion. So it's really just a tiny, tiny portion of our budget.
Well, it's 2%, you know? I mean, I'm sure, seriously, I'm sure the roads take up, I don't know, throwing it out there, 2 or 3% of the budget. It's significant, in other
words. Yeah, it is a significant amount of money, but it wasn't something that we didn't have other mechanisms to cover. You know, this isn't something where we had to have an emergency. We have reserves, and specifically with this case, this was like a projected shortfall, so we could make some adjustments to try to cut down on some of those perceived projected shortfalls.
Okay, so it's a budgetary problem, but it's also a human problem. I'm sure you've talked to people who have been affected by the old rules, which was, as I understand it, newfound amounts of federal money that could, for the first time ever, pay for services to a family member giving their other family member services, and then what happened since. So how's it? How have things changed on the human level?
Federally, you have been allowed to pay parents and spouses as attendant caregivers under a specific program since 2017 nationwide, but each state has to individually adopt a set of rules for that. Indiana has not done that. And that was kind of where the trouble came, was during the pandemic, we didn't have nurses, other states didn't have nurses, still like this across the country. And so parents were asked to kind of step up to fill that caregiver role that the state wanted to have paid nurses for. And what kind of happened was the state, first of all, reflected and realized they didn't actually have federal authority to do this. But secondly, parents really loved this program because it gave them $15 an hour, roughly, and I can go into why, we don't know for sure. And that was, there was no cap for how many hours these parents could charge the state for. So many of these families were actually making a living wage, staying home and providing this sometimes really intensive care for their children. And then with this budget shortfall, they crunched some numbers and realized that this program and its growth, not just in enrollment, but specifically in the expenses going per child, because there's only 1,600 kids in this program. That's where so much growth was coming. And FSSA decided we need to relook at this and curb it.
So just to be clear, 2017, it was made possible that any state could adopt such a program. Indiana declined to do so. Then the pandemic hits. People need nurses and aides. They're not available. So Indiana changes its rules to allow a father or mother to give care to their autistic child, to take a specific example, and the rate of reimbursement would be $15. Am I getting that all right?
Yes. And that's, you know, the parents have to actually go through a provider agency. So the state is not directly paying parents $15. The state is paying these providers actually $34.36 per hour. And then those providers, it appears, FSSA does not seem to have been tracking this, appears the providers gave parents $15 an hour roughly.
Now, there is also the specter, and I don't know if this is just talking about the exception and trying to create a boogeyman out of someone playing the system, but some state senators have talked about some cases where a provider got paid more than $200,000 for the care of a single individual. How does this even work out, one might wonder, $15 an hour? Well, I guess if someone claims that they work 24 hours a day caring for a person, it could get up to $200,000.
Well, and I also want to specify that both parents can be providers in a sense. So,
yeah, because the math, by the way, the math wasn't getting there with $15 times 24 hours. That's still $360 a day. Well, if you include weekends, it actually does get to 200, but go ahead.
And so that's just, you know, if both parents are providing, and that's also to the providers themselves. So theoretically, you know, let's say the parents are getting a little less than half of that. They're getting probably a little more like 100,000 versus the 200,000 that was billed to providers. And that's across two parents, 50K each.
Yeah.
So you can kind of see how these numbers reached about, but really, you know, they were working more than 40 hours or reporting working more than 40 hours. Roughly half reported working more than 60 hours a week with their children.
Now, that's not necessarily illegitimate. These children will need round-the-clock care. Now, that doesn't mean 24-hour billing is legitimate, but a couple questions there. Has it been revealed, maybe through your reporting, that this was widespread, or is this just more the exception that proves the rule and convenient enough talking point for people who want to kill the budget or the program for other reasons?
So FSSA has really not been very clear on a breakdown of this sort of thing. They've given some numbers that we know there are at roughly half of children were charging over, their parents were charging over 60 hours a week. And that is, yeah, it was not clear if that was one parent or two parents, because if that's two parents, completely different situation. But I think that they realized they didn't have any top end maximum reimbursement from the agency. And they also realized that they didn't really have any other guardrails in terms of how much money was going from providers to parents. And, you know, I have to mention actually that even if these parents are on the clock, they have to clock out to do skilled care. For example, if they were doing something with their child's tracheotomy, they would have to clock out because this program only pays for unskilled care.
Uh-huh.
Which is like feeding, dressing, bathing.
So wait, so how does the skill care component affect what we're talking about? They would also get paid for skilled care, or you're saying they take the patient, the child, to a specialist, and at that point they're not on the clock?
Yeah. So let's say, you know, a parent, let's say you're bathing your child and like something happens with one of their medical implements and there's water in it. You have to clock out to fix the medical device, because you cannot do that on the FSSA clock for this attendant care.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it was, there's a lot of this clocking in, clocking out. And that's kind of where the state was also saying, this is really complicated and burdensome. And that's why the state is trying to transition to a per diem, that we don't care how many hours you do it, this is your flat rate for per day. But in comparison, that's like $35,000 a year versus some of these families were getting, you know, $50,000 a year to care for their child.
Yeah, 60 times 15 times 52 is almost $50,000 a year, which, by the way, is legitimate. I don't know if it's legitimate according to the state, but that is that's the care. That's not even enough of the care needed for some of the people that we're talking about. There have been a lot of protests, and I think very sympathetic protests, because you have people in wheelchairs and caregivers who talk about their, you know, severely autistic young child. Can you give us a sense of what messaging has been going on around this program?
Yeah, so the parents kind of established early in January, which our legislative session ran from the second week of January to the second week of March this year. So it was roughly, you know, just over 2 months. And it parents made a point to try to come every Monday to rally. And, you know, families were saying that our state house, of course, being a very old building, is not nearly as accessible. And some families even reported having to drag wheelchairs up the stairs instead of the elevators when it wasn't working out, because we only have one accessible entrance. And it was really fascinating to see, for example, when four wheelchair users and their parents tried to fit in the house chamber, and it was wild. Yeah. Because it's not big enough for that. And I don't know how they would fit.
I've also seen local news reports with, you know, a person, I think the report, specific reports I saw were not a child or a small child, but a person with a breathing tube and their mother, or I think it was their mother, essentially crying about, how can I afford to keep my child alive? And it's unbelievably sympathetic. And I think in those instances, it's very hard for a legislator to say, sorry, we don't have the money. But is that what they're forced to say? Or are there other arguments that they're engaging with to try to counteract the sympathetic images and realities of a lot of these patients who need the money?
The reality is the legislators can't say flat out, we don't have the money, because Indiana has a very healthy savings account. And It's very hard to say that when you look at where our finances are. And I think that it's more they've been painting it as the growth is unsustainable and we need to find a way to fiscally manage that better. Mm-hmm. And so I think that legislators, everybody I've spoken to has talked about how difficult of a needle this is to thread. But the concern is that there were no guardrails on this program, and technically the state didn't have the authority to administer the program in the first place. So we had to go to this daily. And I don't think that parents want that, because there are some children for whom their needs are so complex that they felt like this program did not cover that care whatsoever.
They have to go to a daily reimbursement, you're saying?
Yes.
How did these families survive before the pandemic, before the state provided them any money, even what, if you do the math, is poverty wages?
Yes. So actually, some of the families I talked about, some of the families that I talked to said, you know, essentially our son was living in a closet because that is the space we had. It was, you know, we moved to a rental, we had to sell our house to continue to afford the care that our child needed. And a lot of families talked about having a sense of pride in that the attendant care wages they were receiving allowed them to not be on government programs such as, you know, food stamps or other types of subsidized care, because they were making enough money from this program. And some of them are saying, am I going to have to go back on that now that the program's being rolled back? You know, if we still had something like this, would I be able to survive somewhat on my own 2 feet because I'm getting paid for this care?
Yeah. So what are the politics of this? There is your current governor is not running for re-election. The lieutenant governor is. Tell me about how much, say, the governors or potential governors have and other important people in the state house.
Our governor is actually term limited, so he cannot run again, even if he wanted to. But we have 6 Republican contenders, and one of them is the lieutenant governor, and she has been very outspoken, Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch, I should mention. And she has been very consistent about calling for audits of the overseeing agency and asking for more responses. I will specifically say that it took us weeks to get how many children were affected by this change. You know, we kept asking how many children are in this program that we're looking at ever since, you know, they announced it, I think January 17th, it took them about a month to get it back to us. And you'd think that if you made that change, you'd have that number right at top of mind. But even the lieutenant governor and other lawmakers I was talking to said they didn't have those numbers either. So I think that's kind of been a lot of the heartburn we've been having around this issue, is that it feels like we'll ask questions and then not necessarily get the answer for a couple of weeks. And the lieutenant governor has been very transparent about how frustrated she has been with that and incorporated it into her gubernatorial campaign.
Is this a big issue? Does the average Indiana know about, does the average Hoosier know about this?
Wow, you're about to get me canceled there.
Right? I almost said the I word. Yeah.
You know, I would say that this is something that everybody knows somebody who knows somebody affected by this, but I would not say that this is a leading election issue for people. I think overall healthcare is a leading election issue, but I'm not sure that this subset of Medicaid priorities is really something that's resonating with the greater population as a whole.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's an impossible question. It's a conundrum. And it's also, I mean, I don't want to indulge in just finding how fascinating it is politically, but it is, there are real stakes in human lives, but it is also fascinating politically. Do you find it to be that?
Yes, I have to say, I personally, Medicaid is something I think is a very important program to better understand and cover, because it is a growing part of not only our state's budget, but the entire country. Every state is having problems with their Medicaid budgets right now, to some degree. After the federal government, you know, subsidies from COVID-19 expired, all of the states are reevaluating their Medicaid budgets and trying to decide, what are our priorities moving forward? So I think that I was talking to somebody with Pew about this, but really all states need to be sitting down and kind of reevaluating their Medicaid budgets and creating a long-term plan for how we tackle the growing cost of healthcare and specifically healthcare for people who can't afford it otherwise.
Whitney Downard works for the Indiana Capital Chronicle. That's part of the state's newsroom, the nation's largest state-focused nonprofit news organization. She's been covering the issue of funding for Medicaid services and other services in the state of Indiana. And I want to congratulate you and a little bit me, Whitney, on not saying LRIs, where we have said parents, not LRIs. And what are LRIs?
Legally responsible individuals, usually parents, but sometimes spouses caring for individuals with severe disabilities.
Congratulations on steering us away from that. And thank you very much overall.
Tried very hard to avoid the alphabet soup that is Medicaid.
Thank you, Whitney.
Thank you.
And now the spiel. It was a big day for Donald Trump today. He was told his criminal trial in Manhattan would start April 15th, and he also had his bond reduced by about $300 million by the New York State Appellate Division. He says at that price, I'd be crazy not to pay.
So I greatly respect the decision of the Appellate Division, and I'll post either $175 million in cash or bonds or security or whatever is necessary. Very quickly within the 10 days. And I thank the Appellate Division for acting quickly.
Trump's lawyers had been making the case that their client couldn't possibly come up with the $450 million plus, which led commentators to wonder, would New York State Attorney General Letitia James start carting off golf carts from Trump National? I mean, not her personally, but actually the golf course assets were the subject of liens. I thought it was unlikely that Donald Trump would let that happen, and it didn't, but mostly because of appellate court interference. So what lessons are we to learn? One, don't fraudulently claim that Trump Tower is three times as big. I don't know if we've learned that lesson, actually. I do think, in terms of media coverage, that so much of it is marked by glee at his demise, his imminent demise, always imminent. I admit that I, too, want him to get his just desserts, which, in his case, are vanilla ice cream after a well-done steak. But this is a guy who has lied and defrauded and, I believe, will one day be found guilty of crimes. I don't know where. I doubt it will be in New York in this particular criminal trial. But I also realize that the incentives of the political media are mostly aligned to deliver dopamine hits to Trump haters or Trump lovers. Not all. Not the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, the New York Times. They've been excellent guides as to the reality of Trump's legal exposure. ABC's Aaron Katursky, he's another good one. And in all those outlets, there have been reporting about the various mechanisms that Trump could come up with to produce hundreds of millions of dollars. And he clearly could produce hundreds of millions of dollars. He doesn't have to write a check for it. He'll just get a loan or someone else to write a check for it, and then he would pay a few million dollars down. It's not that easy. In court filings, he said that the surety companies, the bondsmen who normally provide this service, are not touching him, and I understand that. But what really, if push came to shove, would happen is that Trump would have to liquidate assets. He could do that. He just doesn't want to do that. Many commentators took the pleading of the Trump legal team as evidence that Trump was desperate, destitute, and out of options. But what of the other explanation? That they said, you know what? It's worth a try. Because you know what? We could win. And guess what? They did win. Not just on the money, but the appellate division stayed the ban on Trump serving on different boards of directors and other more minor but meaningful aspects of Judge Engoron's ruling. Some commentators get almost all of this entirely wrong.
Looks like on the financial front, Donald Trump is done.
That is Glenn Kirshner, MSNBC and NBC legal analyst. This is from Kirshner's personal podcast. I could have taken the many segments on many podcasts like Mueller, She Wrote or the Medias Touch, I think they call it. Very anti-Trump, pro deus ex machina to deliver us from Trump-type content wishcasting. And I like Glenn Kirshner, personally, but he did get this one wrong. The episode, recorded on Thursday, treated the legal filing that would ultimately save Trump hundreds of millions of dollars as nothing more than just unserious, risible even, and a source of derision.
Let's go through just a little bit of today's court filing by Trump. And friends, full disclosure, we're going to have a little bit of fun with this one. Because I think we deserve to have a little bit of fun anytime actual accountability comes for Donald Trump.
Most of the fun was Kirshner saying over and over again some version of Trump doesn't have the money. Trump's not good for it. Trump's not a rich guy. His thesis was based on this. The court filing, which Kirshner regarded as doomed to fail, showed that Trump could not pay. Because why would he resort to that desperate tactic if the guy could just pay? And I'll tell you the answer to that, as we found out. The tactic saved Trump millions of dollars. Tactic was certainly worth it. And it didn't really give us any insight on Kirshner's assertion, a version of which he repeated 6 times in an 11-minute podcast.
Because he's not as rich as he always falsely claims he is.
Maybe he is. Maybe he isn't. Donald Trump just netted hundreds of millions of dollars on Truth Social. Sure, it's on paper. Sure, it's locked up for a while. Sure, Trump detractors will tell you the underlying business isn't worth what the market is valuing it at, which is also true of some very valuable companies and some not valuable companies. Here's Russ Buettner, author of Lucky Loser, how Donald Trump squandered his father's fortune and created the illusion of success on ABC's This Week.
But it is a remarkable thing to think that a company that is losing, the last report I saw was $50 million last year and has the revenue of like a really successful shoe store is going to somehow be worth billions and billions of dollars, right?
But it does seem to be the case. He's a lot richer today, even on paper, even if locked up. But he is richer and will be richer today than when Buettner wrote the book. Even if we, meaning you, me, Buettner, Glenn Kirshner doesn't like it, and Kirshner doesn't like it, he was last heard engaged in a sort of pleasant reverie, contemplating the consequences of what he regarded as Donald Trump's impending financial ruin.
And you know, friends, I can imagine New York Attorney General Letitia James just sitting back, biding her time, saying, go ahead, Donald, just keep making your arguments, keep trying to delay matters, keep filing your ridiculous little court pleadings, because I'm going to begin seizing your assets.
Today, Kirshner tweeted of the ruling that he did not anticipate, quote, the verdict is in, the rules, the laws, and the Constitution do not apply to Donald Trump the way they apply to you and me. So the court was wrong, and I guess the Constitution is too. Whatever. By the way, Kirshner said on his show that Trump couldn't even pay $18 million, and if that's true, he's going to have trouble finding any amount in the 9 figures, which is due in 10 days. But as I have said, I think Donald Trump will find a way to pay, especially now it's to pay less. But the walls with Trump, in the telling of many Trump observers, the walls are forever closing in. The bill is perpetually about to come due. Yeah, I know, except that thinking is all based on a miscalculation, not by the courts or by Trump, but on those who wouldn't admit what they don't want to admit. That Trump may be lying and lawbreaking and loathsome, but he's also plenty rich, rich enough. We want him to face accountability, but just because his accounting is fraudulent doesn't mean that he's still not resourceful enough to confound the maybe to some people comforting assessment that his latest wound, whatever that wound is, will always be the fatal one. That's it for today's show. The Quaint Mallards produced The Gist. Corey Wara, Gist producer. Joel Patterson, Gist senior producer. Michelle Pesca's in charge of lobster costume procurement for Peachfish Productions. Emmett Pesca is in charge of the wearing of said costume. You will see that soon. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oopero-dee-pero-doo-pero. Thanks for listening.